a lot of people, their phraseology when they're talking, if we can just get 4 clients, that's enough. That's all we need. And I will always push and say, like, no, do not limit yourself. What you have here is such an awesome, interesting experience that's going to change the lives of other people. So you need to shoot bigger. You have to be realistic, but you need to really position yourself to understand that you want this thing to go to the moon. And it's not just because you'll become wealthy in the process. It's because of the lives that you're going to touch along the way.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mark Dolan. I'm your host for Time Tested Mastery, Life Lessons Sell. Today on Time Tested Mastery, I'm joined by Nick Volinchek, a transformation coach, speaker, and the founder of the MicroShift Project. Nick's story is extraordinary. After overcoming addiction and homelessness, he built a successful digital marketing firm, ran a professional wrestling company, and now dedicates his life to helping high-achieving men go beyond success to find true fulfillment. With 20 years of sobriety and a message that's raw, real, and deeply grounded, Nick teaches that the smallest shifts, what he calls micro shifts, can move mountains. His work helps entrepreneurs, executives, and professionals reclaim purpose, break through burnout, and rise with clarity and courage. So please welcome Nick to our show. So welcome to the show, Nick. It's so great to have you here today. I really enjoyed our time together speaking up in Boston and getting to know you a little bit better. Your story begins with incredible adversity, right?
Yeah, and I do want to thank you for having me on here today. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of things, I got to ask a question my late friend, Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney, used to ask.
What's that?
Is Nick Volinchek looking good today or what?
He's looking good. And I know that reference. So share a little bit more about who that person is that asked that question and how you came up with that.
Yeah, it's an homage to an independent professional wrestler who called himself Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney. And he was one of those many, like, innocuous, small, didn't really seem like anything conversations or relationships I had in my life that ended up making a huge, massive change overall. And as Mark kind of intimated early on, you know, I had a very difficult first 20 years of my life, really probably the first 30 years. The last 10 have been much smoother than the first 30. But he was somebody in a time where I had gotten a lot of help to get my life together, to get through all the situations that I was going through personally with addiction and struggling with knowing who I am, what my purpose is, things like that, that we all deal with to some extent through life. And I never really got the full ability to be outward with my story to him. And he ended up taking his own life in 2011. And why he was one of my major micro shifts, you know, one of the 5 that I consider to be transformational in my life, was whereas all of the other ones were all about me and how people helped me, he was the first opportunity that I really had, I felt, to like tell my story to the fullest extent and really held back. And I felt devastated after I kind of sat and realized that not telling my truth and not telling my story. Look, I'm not naive. I don't think singularly that would have been a thing that kept him alive, but I think maybe it could have helped him seek something that he clearly wasn't finding out. So it's kind of my inspiration to continue going, to never be afraid to tell your story, to talk to all the people that you know that need to hear it, and just not be shy about what you've been through.
Right. And so I think that was his introduction, as he was asking the audience, hey, don't I look great today?
Yeah. And he was a wrestler and he played the heel. So as you can imagine, he comes out there and he's smug and the crowd is just booing him. But he had that ability to just turn a crowd into putty with his words. And, you know, there's a lot, I think, we can take from people in life. And that's why I think having that background in professional wrestling will actually help me in my speaking career, because I saw a lot of people who were really good at understanding how to connect with a crowd do it.
Yeah. And we are going to talk a little bit about that. But the beginning of your story talks about some incredible adversity. I know it involves addiction and homelessness. And most of my audience is doesn't come from a background of addiction and recovery, but they do come from adversity. But in order to create sort of a sort of do the setup. Can you sort of share, you know, what was going on in your life and the turning point that moved you to make a change? And then we're going to take that conversation a little bit further.
Yeah, I think, you know, not going into the greatest details, but my mom passed very early on in life. I was 8 years old, about to be nine. And it kind of set off a chain of events. There was a lot of abuse from my father, and we've rectified this as I've gotten older. And there's never, and it's okay that it happened, but we've been able to move past it. I think for me, what really started happening is I was in high school, and you know, the movies at the time were like American Pie, Can't Hardly Wait, Clueless. You know, it's showing what I thought high school was supposed to look like, which is partying, hanging out with a whole bunch of people, being popular. And I found myself in some dude's basement with like 8 teenage boys, incapable of talking to girls, incapable of socially interacting, and just playing GoldenEye. And I really just started to feel like this isn't it. This isn't, you know, what I'm living isn't what I'm seeing on the screen. And so I started to change myself essentially, and I was figured out how to become social a little bit. And very quickly, I turned into a fun guy to have at parties, full Rolodex in my phone book of people to call and hang out with. And before you know it, Mark, and you know with your background, fun becomes necessity very quick. So I went from a point where drugs were fun to where I woke up in the morning and I needed to take drugs in order to go on with that day. And, you know, we'll say this is probably 16. So 16th through 21, it all kind of started to accelerate very fast. And I found myself right before my 21st birthday, give or take, at the point where my dad woke me up with a restraining order and said, "You got to get the hell out of here." Canfield police removed me from his house, and I was living in my car. I wanted to die. I tried. I was really bad at trying to kill myself, but I wasn't really, like, it was half-hearted attempts. And then I just had a kind of weird interaction with some people at where I was basically at my lowest point, and they were, you know, they had stopped because my car broke down and it ran out of gas, and they were transporting me to my dad's house to get a gas can, and they were having like a real conversation with me like I was a human being.
Right.
And I started to feel like, man, this is weird. And before I got out of the car, they told me, you know, the lady grabbed me by my arm and said, "Listen, you're going to make it through this. We love you. You have a lot to live for." Something, a variation of that. I still wasn't mentally prepared in that moment. I was just kind of like, okay, cool, thanks, bye. But it started eating away at me. And then I started having other interactions, and then finally ended up at the homeless shelter, where I really had to look at myself in the mirror and be like, you are the cause. You might have had some things that weren't fairly dealt to you, but you certainly didn't have a situation where everything was completely unfair, and it is especially was not out of your control. You caused it. You were the one making the decisions. And I think that night at the mission, when I first got there, that was really the moment where I was like, you know what? I caused this to myself. I did this damage, and these people are right. I do have a lot to live for. I do have a lot to give. And now it's time to start making those repairs to the relationships and everything else that I had destroyed, most first and foremost, my own life.
So I'm going to stop you there for a second, because a lot of people that, you know, say, well, I, you know, I don't have problems with addiction. You know, that's not an issue for me. I don't want them to miss out the message, because the other thing that you said was that it was almost like being on a treadmill, or to be on a hamster wheel, is that, you know, once you get into a cycle of things, that you sort of get stuck, and, you know, you can get stuck in addiction. You can get stuck in unhealthy behaviors. You can get stuck in apathy and lethargy. I mean, you can get stuck in a lot of different areas and sort of be on a hamster wheel towards failure. And so I think I want people to make that connection if they say, well, you know, I don't have the addiction issue that Mark and Nick have. So how can I relate? Well, there are things that we do that prevent us from reaching our potential. And so I want people to think of what that is for them. One of the things that you shared with me, one of your principles that I really love, is you said, you know, I want to go beyond surviving to thriving. And I see a lot of people, you know, in addiction that will say, if I just stop drinking or if I stop taking the drugs, everything's okay. If somebody that's in business, you know, particularly real estate people, you know, they'll say, well, if I just sell enough houses to pay my bills, then it's okay. You know, they stop at the survival level. And so my question to you is, what was that process like for you to move from surviving to thriving? Because I think that's a really key message for people.
Yeah, I think part of it was really accepting, you know, accepting where I was at and the thoughts that I had and how untrue they were. Because even though I came through the addiction side of things, I still looked at myself many days, if not most of the days, and said, can I really do this? Am I actually strong enough to be able to go out and have impact on this world? And I think that that self-doubt and lack of confidence is something that many people, and if not most people, deal with at some point in their lives. And that's what causes those thoughts of just trying to make ends meet or just trying to do the bare minimum, because they know that they have to challenge themselves to say, I can do this. And it's crazy because it's three words, four words, I can do this, I can do this. It's four words, but it is like the most complicated thing to really ingrain within ourselves. And so I think for me, that's kind of the main thing that I think you could take away from the addiction background to just the things I dealt with early on in my adult professional life, imposter syndrome. And that's something still to this day that I struggle with from time to time. And I know it's just that lack of confidence, and maybe it's just some karmic energy out there trying to stop you from being the best version of yourself you could be. But I think at the end of the day, you have to understand you have a unique skill set. It may take some digging to figure out exactly what that is, but you have tools within you that can change the world. And the key there in changing the world is understanding that it could just be helping one person in one small way, because then they take it forward and tell five people and it multiplies exponentially that quickly.
I need to take you back to a phrase that you used. I know what it means for me, but I don't think a lot of our audience members know what this means. Can you describe what imposter syndrome means?
Imposter syndrome means, so for me, what it means is I am doing something successfully, but I feel like it's more by chance than by skill or my own intent, right? And I think you see this especially a lot with professional people, definitely with people that have other people working underneath them, because they can always explain it away to themselves that, well, I'm only making it this far because of the team I have underneath me. If I didn't have these strong people, I would be basically nothing. And it all does, to me, stem from that like lack of confidence, but it also stems from this fear of failure. And I think I've heard on a training with Brian Proctor, and he said that you never fail if you're trying to live out your dreams, something like that. And to me, that was like a wow. And if you're trying your best, I mean, if you don't have imposter syndrome, if you're sitting around and expecting everything to come to you, you're just lazy, right? But if you're trying and you're putting forth effort and you're constantly trying to make change and be the best version of yourself you can be working towards that goal, you should not be afraid of failure, because most people won't go out there and try to do something for themselves. Right? Yeah. Most people won't try to change themselves for the better. So just keep pushing at it and you could work past that imposter syndrome.
The key to what you talked about for me in the imposter syndrome is the fear of failure. And there's another part of it. And I see this a lot with salespeople, is they will get into a negotiation with a person on the other side of a transaction and they will be intimidated by the other salesperson, or they'll be intimidated by the outsides of what they see with a client. You know, they'll see the car that they pull up in. And conversely, I mean, there can be people that, you know, don't necessarily have imposter syndrome, but they judge themselves, their egos come out, and they judge themselves superior to somebody that they see. So a lot of this perception of the things that go on in our mind can change, it can really affect us in a negative way. You know, going into, you know, this surviving to thriving, is there an example that you can think of in your business career or in your coaching career where there was somebody that was just surviving and there was something that you did or something helped them to do to move them to thriving versus just getting by?
Yeah, we've had a couple of clients on the marketing side of things who have come to us and they have just like a really good idea and it's something that is missing in their marketplace, but would provide like an impactful change to the lives of people that they're working with. And so that's always the funnest kind of client to work with, where you're able to help them realize their dream. And in turn, they're able to help other people realize their dream. And you find that a lot of these people, just their phraseology when they're talking about only need four clients, if we can just get four clients, that's enough. That's all we need. And I will always push and say, like, no, do not limit yourself. What you have here is such an awesome, interesting experience that's going to change the lives of other people. So you need to shoot bigger. You have to be realistic, but you need to really position yourself to understand that you want this thing to go to the moon. And it's not just because you'll become wealthy in the process. It's because of the lives that you're going to touch along the way. So you have to really try to work with someone's mentality. And look, I saw it too. I worked at the rescue mission for 10 years after I went through my homeless phase. And when the people come in there, they were just like I am, thinking all I've been told for the last 1 to 50 years of my life is that I'm worthless, I'm just a drug addict, I'm never going to make it. And if you're putting that limit on yourself, that is as far as you can go. If you're willing to like understand that there's so much more that you have to give, and it's not look at me and look what I've done, but imagine what you could do if you just let go of what's holding you down. And you'll be surprised, even if you just say something simple like that, with certain people, it will click and resonate, and they'll go on to do tremendous things.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a great sort of a segue into one of the things that I really like you saying. It's you say you're one shift away from momentum. You know, just one shift away from momentum, and you sort of gave a clue in that answer. Can you explain the philosophy behind microshifts?
Yeah, I think it started when I would have conversations with people, and I would talk about my background or whatever it might be, and they would always listen to what I had said and try to pick like the biggest things that happened in my life, like my mom died, or, you know, I ended up at the homeless shelter, as being like the things that had the most impact on me. And I have to correct them and say, like, well, yes, they inevitably had influence on my life, but I could tell you that there were like these very small conversations that most people you would never assume would have been like the thing that got you going on your path or reaffirmed something. Those have been the things that have like lit the fire underneath me. I mean, we talked about the strangers who pulled over to me. It can be as simple as, you know, a couple weeks later, yeah, I get pulled over and I have no license. I have no insurance. I'm drunk and high. And there's evidence of that in the car that I'm living in. But the cop sees that there's bags full of clothes in my back seat and quickly puts together that I'm probably living in this car based how off of the situation he sees, and opposed to cuffing me and throwing me deeper into a system that I've already lived in for 5 years, he showed me dignity and compassion and was willing to take me to the rescue mission. Those are the things that happened to me. Somebody being willing to just have a frank, and ironically the guy's name was Frank, but a frank and honest conversation to hold up a mirror to let me realize that, hi, it's me. I'm the problem. It's not all these things that people have told me through my life. My mom died. My dad hit me. My dad didn't show. No. When you are exposed to seeing a 3-year-old child sitting in the dining hall of a homeless shelter, you quickly get humbled because that child had no choice in the matter. I had food on my table every day at home. I had a roof over my head. Not everybody is afforded those same luxuries that we take for granted. Those are the things that had the big impacts on my life, as opposed to some big grandiose thing, you know, opening up a wrestling company. That might have been one of the biggest accomplishments in your life. Like, yeah, I was able to live out a dream, but the fact that I was able to talk to someone when he came into the rescue mission as an 18-year-old cokehead, and this past Christmas, he was over our house sober for 20 years as well, or 18 years, 15 years as well, because of my interactions with him, that's what I'm proud of. That's what excites me, being able to look at him and be like, man, I'm not directly responsible for this kid getting where he is, but I had the smallest impact that got him to start thinking, and that makes me feel great.
Okay. So whether it is substance issues, whether it is childhood trauma, whether it is lack of finances, anybody that is stuck, what would be your suggestion to anyone that finds themselves stuck? What would be your first suggestion for a bold shift, probably in their thinking, I suspect? What would you talk with somebody about?
So it's interesting that you mentioned that. You kind of stole my answer, but it really is to talk. I mean, even if, you know, I have a standing appointment every Monday with somebody to talk. And I don't even really necessarily expect like a plan or anything like that. I just find that being able to get the things out of me, that as I just talk through some things, I'll be like, oh my goodness, and have these revelations or refer to the solution to my own problem. So I think a lot of times people, it does get kind of twofold. Sometimes people are afraid to talk, or sometimes people won't have people that they can talk to. You know, and that's the thing. So if you're finding yourself in the first situation, we all need help. You will find, I don't know if you'll find anybody who's been able to get to the top without somebody helping, or even get to sea level without somebody helping them. And if you don't have anyone to talk to, you know, find, there's plenty of resources out there. You could, I mean, even, you know, I reach out to me. I'll gladly donate. I don't want money. Just, you need someone to talk to. I'm happy to sit and talk and converse with someone just if it helps them be able to get that out of them, because you feel lighter. There's more clarity. You feel more unburdened as you go on through these things, and it helps you live life with more peace. And then as you start to find that peace, you start to see things open up, and you're viewing life maybe in a way you haven't in a while, or maybe never, to where some things that were before kind of hidden behind a curtain start to reveal themselves. And you're like, hey, I really love this thing. This is where I would be the happiest doing this thing. And it doesn't have to be a CEO of a multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 company. It can be, I find so much joy in picking up trash off the street. It can be little things. We always gravitate towards the grandiose, but it could just be something little that we find we love to do, that our renewed sense of life gives us the ability to find joy in.
So, you know, so conversations, talking with somebody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's that phrase that, you know, when you share a burden that you're carrying with somebody else, the load becomes half,
yeah.
And we're going to talk about tribes a little bit later, so I don't want to go into that yet. But I know that the other thing that you said something was about, you know, change of what people thought about themselves. And, you know, I remember when I first became aware of affirmations, I thought that I didn't use affirmations until one day I was making scrambled eggs, and I was sort of stirring the scrambled eggs with a fork, and I dropped the fork into the scrambled eggs. And I said, man, that was stupid. And then I thought about it for a second. I said, no, that wasn't stupid. That was a mistake. I mean, everybody, you know, you can drop, you know, a fork into the eggs, and that's not stupid, but it was that self-talk. It was the message that I was telling myself that was doing so much damage. And to take that further with talking with other people is that sometimes we can say crazy things to ourselves, things that are not true. And when we talk to somebody else like you or some of the people that you've talked with that are knowledgeable and care about what's going on, if they hear that crazy talk, they'll correct us and they can sort of guide us out of that. So I can see the wisdom in that.
Isn't it funny how we are oftentimes our own worst enemies with everything that we do? Like, because just to your point, I hear you say something like that. And I think about just a few weeks ago when we were doing a training call, and I made a comment about like, well, I wish I had done this differently with my speech. And the person had to be like, can you stop? Like, don't beat yourself up. And it was, there was more depth to it in that. I don't want to take up time necessarily going into it, but it really made me sit and think, like, I'd still do this to myself sometimes, where I work myself into a corner where I can't just say it was a good experience and I got a lot out of it and just make it all positivity, where I still frame it like I could have done better. And even if that's true, you don't, moving forward with that mentality, so the next time I try to do that, that's going to be eating away in the back of my head, and it's going to adversely affect the next time I do something. Now that I've been course corrected, I don't feel like I'm going to have that same voice in the back of my head. You know what I mean? I feel like I'm going to go more ahead more confidently and feel better about it. So yeah, it's a perfect representation of how, again, just one little micro conversation had a big shift in my perception of how I'm going to handle something moving forward.
Yeah. You know, the key for a musician that is a songwriter that wants to write good songs, they have to write bad songs and then write better ones to get to a good song.
Fair point.
The salesperson that does that wants to master their presentation has to be willing to do a bad presentation and improve it over time. Yeah, that fear of failure, I think, is pretty pervasive, I think, is the word I was looking for. So, you know, I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, you have a phrase that I like that you've shared, and the phrase is cause over cash.
Mm.
You know, cause over cash. And I know that there's a lot of people that, you know, I think I shared in my talk, you know, when we were up in Boston, is that there's a lot of people that say, I'm not working for free. And they have their mind on the money rather than on what you find value. And so can you explain that, you know, cause over cash and how you've applied that to your business?
Yeah, definitely. So I think specific to what I'm doing here, because of my background in marketing, we've worked with coaches and consultants, and many times we have not pursued business relationships with potential clients because we can see that people are trying to monetize and only monetize the vulnerabilities that we all have, right? So there's no question that someone who I'm going to coach on a one-on-one basis it's going to be a soul emptying process. There's going to be a lot of vulnerabilities. One of the main reasons that I think I would only want to work with men versus women, because vulnerabilities with women are a little bit different than vulnerabilities with men when you're a man. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier for me to speak with less potential risk to how the person I'm talking to might take my listening skills. But bigger point, we see all the time that people are like, okay, well, I need to have an introductory offer to get people in, to ascend them up to like the next level of package with us, and then ascend them again. And then ultimately, we want to get them here where they're paying us, you know, blah, 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 blah per year. You listen to these people talk and you're like, okay, so like, great, you've designed a business, but like, how do you help again? What are you actually addressing? Or is it just you're putting your hand out at every step and saying more and more and more? So for me, I know that I have limited time and I want to be as impactful as possible with my time. So I'm really, first and foremost, honestly, I want to talk. I want to be a speaker. I want to get out there and talk to people as a whole, as opposed to coaching. But if I do coaching, it is one-on-one only. And it's very intent to the person where like, I have to feel that I know I'm going to be able to help this person, or I feel like they're going to be putting in the amount of time that I'm going to be putting in. And so I expect that number of people that I help to be very small. And then I know you have a question about a tribe, so we'll save that for a little bit later. But I do have some, you know, I have some thoughts about that, how I plan on handling that. But overall, that's kind of my perspective, is to make sure to be authentic and transparent. Like those are my biggest things, because people in the circumstances that they're in who are listening to stuff that I talk about, they're emotionally vulnerable, and I don't want to try to materialistically capitalize on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of distrust out there. So if people think that the relationship is only utilitarian, that you're only there for the money, you really can't do the work
right
necessarily that needs to be done in order to get that transformation in process. So I think one of the masters of motivation, Zig Ziglar, said you can get everything you want out of life if you're willing to help enough people get what they want. And so that idea of service, you know, you have cause over cash. So you have to have a mission that is more important than the cash, kind of thing. So I can appreciate that. Do you have any advice for leaders who might be tempted to chase profits at the expense of their own personal well-being and their own purpose, if they have it designed, I guess?
Yeah, it only ends one way. I mean, you never hear the story being good, because even if they are able to achieve, what's the old saying, and it might even be biblical, what does it profit a man if he loses his own soul in the process? And that really is what you tend to see, because it might not be his own soul necessarily, but it's the relationships he has. It's the deprioritization of the things that I won't even say should be prioritized, you know. And when I say things, I can only say things from how I perceive life. But what I do is I say, this is the stuff that I need to do with my family. This is the stuff I'm going to do with my friends. And then work and everything else is just carved out around that. I think way too many people, we've been trained that like we're here to work almost. And it's just like, really? I don't think that that's the reason why we were put here. And so I think you tend to see leaders who end up in these really bad mental health situations is because they chased the dragon. Best book I've ever read, and I encourage everybody to read it, especially if you have an addiction background. It's called The Heroin Diaries by Nikki Sixx. And Nikki Sixx was the bassist for Motley Crue. And effectively, this is a guy who had everything. And he wrote a book for months and maybe years on end while he was shooting up heroin in his closet. I mean, so what it does is it gives you the insight, the mentality of what's going on in someone's head who is doing this activity that he wants to stop doing, but he can't because he's physically addicted to it. But that mental side of it is there too. You can be physically addicted and mentally addicted to narcotics, right? But you can definitely be mentally and then to some extent physically addicted to that pursuit of power, that chasing the dragon. That's a term they use, not to get too into it, but when you shoot up for the first time, it's the best high you're ever going to have, no matter how much you ever do. So they say you're constantly chasing that dragon, that thing that you're never going to find again. And I think business leaders have a tendency to do that as well, where it's just everything else is not important. I need to chase. I need to be the best. I need to get to the top. And then they get to the top and look around and be like, I have nothing. I have a hollow emptiness where I achieved this activity but lost everything in the process. So I think you have to be willing to understand that those types of pursuits can be important, but not at the potential loss of everything around you.
So I want to get into what your feelings are about tribes and how that works with transformation. You know, we know that, you know, a lot of high achievers, and you're just describing it, suffer from burnout, isolation. They are, you know, not necessarily happy. You know, I think your description of Nikki Sixx, you know, meant that he was desperately unhappy, but he was self-medicating with something that even though he was unhappy, he didn't feel as unhappy because he was taking this chemical.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure that book explains, you know, really a lot of sickness mentally as well as physically. But how does the tribe, you know, why is the tribe important to you, and how does that help with transformation?
I think it's the biggest advantage we can give to ourselves, right? Because especially when it's people that are in the same or a similar circumstance on the other side of where you're at, meaning, if you come into a situation where you're down and depressed because you feel like you're not good enough to be at the position you're at, you don't think it's going to hold out because you don't have confidence in yourself being able to actually do what it seems like you've been able to do, and you're in a safe place where you can have open discussions about your vulnerabilities and your feelings and how they're impacting every area of your life, and four or five different people can raise their hand and say, hey man, I know you might not want to hear this right now, but I was in the same headspace as you. I felt the same thing as you, and here's how I dealt with it. And you see the willingness of other people being able and willing to use their life experiences, some that are not always comfortable to talk about, to help you get to a better point in your life. That's when you really start to realize it takes a community to really elevate all of us to the positions that we can be in this life. And so I think finding those people who are willing to uplift you and not just trying to do it for a personal gain, but because they've been helped through by a similar process and they want to see everyone else, you know, think back to when you come off drugs, like when I wanted everyone else to feel that same joy that I felt, you know, and I had a captive audience because that's mainly what brought people to the homeless shelter. But I was like, I feel so empowered and free right now that I wish every single person could feel like this. So when you're struggling, having people around you like that is way more likely to help you, you know, rise tides around you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember hearing the phrase, the most powerful words in the human language is me too. And I think that's what, when you're talking about community, you know, Me Too is the way that recovery works for people. That tribe helps each other. They walk together. Somebody behind you, somebody in front of you is walking that path to recovery. You know, we talk a lot in business about mastermind groups. We talk about role play partners and, you know, accountability partners. I mean, everything that we do can't be in isolation. It has to be in relationship with other people. And I remember Jim Rohn saying, you know, the question, who am I around? What have they got me thinking? What have they got me doing? What have they got me believing? What have they got me reading? And the big question, is that okay? And, you know, from my standpoint, as I listen to what you shared and what my personal belief is the greatest barrier to that is trust. It's trust. Can you trust to be vulnerable with someone else? So this is maybe taking us in a direction that you weren't expecting. So I'm giving you sort of a little bit of time, but how do you develop trust, or what would you advise somebody that needs to make a change but doesn't trust people enough to talk about it?
It's definitely a difficult conversation to try to have, because if someone is not willing to trust, it is likely because multiple people have abused that trust at some point, right? It might not be directly correlated with the specific thing that they're going through in the moment, but somewhere along the way, life has had several interactions with this person, with people who have abused their trust. As naive as it can sound sometimes, especially with situations like this, you want to try to look for as much evidence as you can. So I mean, like, we have a whole internet that we can look at to see, do I feel like this person is trying to take advantage of me? But really, it's just being willing to trust, to know that, like, if your trust has already been broken, what is it really honestly going to hurt if it's broken again, in the pursuit of trying to make sure that you can become the best version of yourself? You know, I think the same way about failure, right? And it helped. I always put myself back in this mentality when I'm afraid to fail. I think about, like, I lived in my car and at a homeless shelter. So I'm pretty sure that failure, whatever failure I might go through in this moment, isn't going to be as severe as that failure. I'm pretty sure we've been to bottom and I'll be able to deal with it. So I think that, you know, just being willing to trust and be vulnerable, like, it might not work out, but I don't think that there's any, like, equation or 100% guarantee. Trying to think of the line from Tommy Boy. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie where he talks about a brake pad. Like, you can put a guarantee on this. Well, I won't say it because I don't remember it, but it basically was like, there's no way to give someone a guarantee. You can put a guarantee on a product, but you come to me and then I could still be like, yeah, I'm not honoring that. So,
well, and when I'm talking with a seller and they ask me what their home is worth, I always tell them, you know, I can't give them an exact number unless I'm the one that's willing to write a check for the house.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah. There is, you know, there's a best guess, there's a most likely, there's a preponderance of evidence, if we look for it, but there really is no guarantee. That's for sure. Interesting. Okay. So as I'm sitting here thinking, your tagline, the micro shift, I know that there's a book in the works.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you to describe for the audience, you know, what that book might look like and what they could expect from that book when you write it and it's published.
Yeah, I think the plan is to really write about my five unique experiences that I went through and put them in more applicable terms to how people can use the mentality that it took me years to understand, like, in the moment, you know, because I think that I don't want the book to be strictly biographical, right? I want it to be able to be something that people can look and immediately understand how they could apply what they're reading into their own lives. So I view it kind of from that perspective. It will definitely be funny because I cannot be 100% serious all the time. Every time I talk to someone, they're like, oh, so you're, what kind of speaking you're doing? I'm like, well, when I really get out there, it's going to be 65% motivational speaker and 35% stand-up comedian. There's no doubt in my mind. I can't do it. But I want it to be something that someone, when they put down the book, they can say, hey, I added a new page to my survival guide today. I learned something that I'm able to take forward in my everyday life and apply, right? That's what my goal is. And I'm excited. I've always wanted to write a book. And so it's starting to come along. I'm hoping, you know, I love Christmas, so it'd be really nice to have it out by the holidays. So that would be really cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear about the book and see the book when you're ready with it. I'm sure that we'll talk along the way with the journey as you're going through it. But for those that have not met you that are listening today, Nick, how can they reach you and find out more about the MicroShift Project? How can they find you, you know, website, contact information, social media? Share how they can find you.
Yeah, right now it's themicroshift.com for a website. And then my social handles are at Nick from CWE, CWE being the name of my wrestling company, Championship Wrestling Experience. People keep telling me I should change it to my name. I don't know. I don't care. I have an attachment, obviously, to Nick from CWE, so I'm probably going to keep it there. And yeah, lots of fun stuff. I got my first podcast back yesterday, so we'll be putting some of that stuff up. And I'm starting my own podcast as well. I finally got through the first 6 episodes, so I'm hopeful, Mark, you know, putting you on the spot. I hope to see you jump on the podcast in a couple of weeks once I'm recording, you know, guest spots. And I think, yeah, that's going to be a fun time too.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, Nick, it's been a pleasure to meet you and to share the stage with you and to learn from you and also have you guest today to talk to the people that are listening to the podcast. I will definitely be on your show when you have it ready to go. And so I'm looking forward to that. And if anybody is wondering if you're going to be a comedian, all they have to do is go back to the introduction and listen to how you introduced yourself when we first came into the show. So I appreciate that. And until next time, my name is Mark Dolan from Time Tested Mastery, Life Lessons Sell. And remember that even ordinary people like myself can do extraordinary things. And that's what we're talking about here at Time Tested Mastery. That's what we're learning here, the principles that you can adapt into your life to do extraordinary things without being famous, without being a movie star, without being, you know, record-setting musician. We can all do wonderful things, and I'm looking forward to doing that together. So until then, we'll talk to you soon.